authority to give us incentives and to inflict sanctions if we continue on the wrong path, and to join hands with players on the ground, civil society in Israel and Palestine, to create a new roadmap and to incentivize political actors on both sides to understand that we need to tell a new story in the Middle East, one of peace and not of of war.
Yonatan Zeigen, Israeli peace activist, social worker, mediator, son of the renowned Canadian-Israeli peace activist Vivian Silver, who was killed on October 7th in the Hamas attack on Kibbutz Be'eri, where she lived, and Gideon Levy, Israeli journalist and Haaretz columnist, member of the Haaretz editorial board, both speaking to us from Tel Aviv. Next up, over 10,000 hotel workers are on strike across the United States to demand raises and fair workloads. We'll speak with a striking hotel room attendant and the local president of the union Unite here in San Francisco. Back in 30 seconds.
Down by the deep water where the sweet lilies stand, I saw pretty Polly a ring in her hands. And the song that she sang made the whole world to ring. My Billy has left me to fight for a king. And I wish the wars were all over. I stood in the banks to hear what she said. I'll follow my Billy, whether living or dead. The notes that she sang.
I wish the wars were all over, by Joan Baez. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. As much of the United States marked Labor Day Monday, more than 10,000 hotel workers with the union Unite here went on a three-day strike across a number of U.S. cities.
No pension! No peace! No benefits! No peace! No respect! No peace! No contract! No peace! No
equality! Hotel union workers are fighting for wage increases, better staffing levels, fair workloads, and respect. Today, the third day of the strike, taking place at 25 hotels, part of the Hilton, Hyatt, Marriott, Westin, and DoubleTree chains in nine cities: Baltimore, Boston, San Diego, San Francisco, San Jose, Seattle, Honolulu, Kauai, and Hawaii, and Greenwich, Connecticut, and more. For more, we're joined by two guests. Lizzie Tapia is the president of Unite Here Local 2 in San Francisco, and Rebecca LaRocque is a striker and room attendant at the Hyatt Regency in Greenwich, Connecticut, has been a room attendant for over 12 years. Lizzie Tapia, let's start with you. Explain the strategy here, the cities you've chosen, the hotel chains that you're negotiating with, and what you're demanding.
No, we've been in negotiation for months now, and we have not seen the kinds of proposals that our members will, you know, that will meet our members' needs. So we've been on strike. Today is day three. There are seven cities that are out today, and it's about 9,500 workers that are out here on day three. And, you know, we're looking for a contract that meets what we need to be able to survive, especially here in the Bay Area. Cost of living is so high, and we need to see good wage increases in health care, retirement plan. And this is also a fight that's really about respect. And so we're hoping that these companies, Hilton, Marriott, and Hyatt, will get the message.
And Lizzie Tapia, are these the only hotels currently that Unite Here has expired contracts with, or is there a larger universe of hotels that you've decided not to strike at this point?
Yeah, there's definitely a larger universe of hotels, but we've been in bargaining with these quickly for the past couple of months, and so that's where we're at today.
And in terms of the differences in pay scales between some of these cities, so for instance, for housekeepers in Boston get $28 an hour, whereas in Baltimore they only get $16.20. Are you trying to do create some sort of more rational system across the board nationwide?
No, I would say what is consistent across the board is the need for very significant wage increases. Everyone is struggling, especially coming out of the pandemic, to make ends meet. And that might mean different things in different cities, but what it means across the board is we need big wage increases, meaningful wage increases, where we can actually afford to survive.
I want to bring Rebecca LaRocque into the conversation. Can you talk about what you do at the Hyatt Regency in Greenwich, Connecticut?
Yes, I'm doing room attendant.
And that means, explain the work that you do and what do you want to see happen and how do you think the hotel is responding?
Okay, like a room attendant, we clean room every day. That's my job. And you said what I'm waiting for, the hotel is going to be attended.
How is the hotel chain, how is the Hyatt responding to the strike outside that you're a part of?
Okay, they don't say nothing for now, but I hopefully we're waiting for an answer. But I don't say nothing for now.
And also, could you talk, a lot of hotels now allow guests to opt out of room cleaning. How has this affected the workload and the conditions of the housekeepers?
Okay, for all those housekeepers, we're working hard. They give you a lot of room every day. We're working hard. And that's why we complain about that. Not only we got a lot of room and we got a lot of job to do, and then we don't pay well. That's why today we are on strike.
And Lizzie Tapia, could you talk about this issue of guests being allowed to opt out of room cleaning and what that does to the workers in the union?
Yeah, Rebecca's absolutely right. When hotels no longer provide automatic daily room cleaning, it creates a workload issue for room attendants who are, you know, cleaning those rooms. When a room is not cleaned for 3 days or 5 days at a time, it's sticky, it's dusty, it requires double the amount of work to clean. And hotel companies don't then adjust your workload, right? It just means that room attendants, like Rebecca said, go home and they're tired and their bodies hurt. And it's totally unacceptable. And it's also, you know, I think it's sort of creating a new model for guests to just not expect that their room will be clean. So, or not get that as part of what they pay for their room. And so it takes away from the guest and from the worker who any, you know, those who are working double as hard. And those who are not working because rooms are not being assigned are at home trying to make ends meet, you know, trying to get a paycheck that they can survive on.
And Rebecca LaRocque, can you talk about the workforce? Is it largely made up of women and immigrants? And if you can talk about the financial instability you've experienced and your coworkers have experienced working at such a prominent hotel, the Hyatt Regency. People associate that, of course, with wealth, but those are the guests.
Okay, all my coworkers always complain every day. Not only the job is hard, and then we can survive with the money they pay us. And when we finish work, when we go home, we can do nothing. Because every my coworkers have a story. Because we're working hard, and then the money they pay, you cannot afford nothing with this because everything's going up. That's why we ask for a better wage, health insurance, and pension, because we cannot afford nothing. And Connecticut is, all those things is very high. After the pandemic, everything's going up.
Yes, I'd like to ask Lizzie Tapia, you declared a 3-day strike. Why 3 days? And are there possibilities for extending the strike?
Yeah, there are no plans right now, but future strikes are possible. Our members are committed to do what it takes to win the contract here. And like Rebecca pointed out, you know, people are tired, they're hurting, they're struggling. And so, you know, we've reached this point, not because we really ultimately want to be in this position, but we're really committed to winning a contract that's fair here. And part of this action was about really coming out on Labor Day and being together on Labor Day in so many cities, all together. But there, you know, there are no plans right now. There are possible actions in the future.
Time, Lizzie. The demands around wages, staffing levels, fair workloads, what are the sticking points in these contract negotiations?
Yeah, I mean, you spelled them out, Amy. I think that what our members are experiencing is really about disrespect and the fact that these hotel companies are cutting amenities and cutting services. What that means is that without automatic daily room cleaning or the bar and restaurant being closed, the limited hours of in-room dining or no in-room dining, limited hours on pools or closing of fitness centers, all those kinds of things translate to our members not being able to work. You know, members who previously cleaned the lobby at night won't be there. Members who, you know, bartenders, servers, food and beverage workers not being there. That's, you know, people are at home. And then for those who are there trying to make up for the lack of staffing, their workload is really hard. It's much harder. It's two or three times harder than it used to be. And so I think a lot of our issues are really about respecting our work. And that's partly why we're, you know, have that message and also respecting our guests. Those things are really related. And so it might come down to money for the bosses. And like Rebecca said, there's a lot of economic issues for us too, but I think largely what it takes to resolve this is really about respecting our work and respecting what we do and bringing hospitality back into those hotels. And that's how all these things are sort of related.
Well, we want to thank you both for being with us. Lizzie Tapia, president of Unite Here Local 2 in San Francisco, and Rebecca LaRoque, striker and home and hotel room attendant at the Hyatt Regency in Greenwich, Connecticut, has been a room attendant for over 12 years. Again, this strike against Hyatt, Hilton, and Marriott. Marriott owns Westin, and Hilton owns DoubleTree. Next up, the New Yorker has published 10 photographs of the U.S. Marines' 2005 massacre of at least 24 Iraqi civilians in the town of Haditha. Stay with us. Rahim Alhaj. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. A warning to our audience, the following story contains graphic images and descriptions of violence. The New Yorker has published 10 photographs of the U.S. Marines' 2005 massacre of 24 Iraqi civilians in the Iraqi town of Haditha. Their killings in the middle of the night came in retaliation for an attack on a U.S. military convoy as it drove through Haditha. The convoy hit a roadside bomb, an IED placed there by Iraqis resisting the U.S. invasion. It killed Lance Corporal Miguel Terrazas. The gruesome images published last week show dead Iraqi men, women, and children, many of them shot in the head at close range. One of the victims, a 5-year-old girl named Zineb Yunus Salim, is seen with the number 11 written on her back with a red marker. The release of the photos comes 19 years after the massacre and only after producers of the investigative podcast series In the Dark sued the Navy, the Marine Corps, and U.S. Central Command to force them to turn over the photos and other records. This is a trailer for In the Dark.
It's now about 17:30, and we're finishing up the day here at a observation post And right now, for about the last 10, 15 minutes, you can hear in the background the evening singing from the minarets.
Believe it or not, sooner or later, we will kill some of these folks who need to be killed. And that's the beautiful thing about this world, is that there's always someone who needs to be killed. And we're the folks to do it.
I spent the past 4 years investigating a crime. A crime that most people have long forgotten.
He heard the sound of really strong bombing.
I heard M16.
A crime that for almost 20 years has gone unpunished.
They went into the room and they were just taking shots.
Me and Noor, we were under the bed. He gets his rifle and then start shooting at us.
How did they not perceive that these were children?
I remember I opened a Humvee and I just seen bodies stacked up. I opened another one, same thing. I'm like,
a 4-year investigation, hundreds of interviews, thousands of documents, all in an effort to see what the U.S. military has kept from the public for years.
You know, I don't know what's to be gained by this investigative journalism.
I'm not interested in talking about that. That was a long time ago, and I tried to move past all that, so no thank you on all that.
He was saying it was so traumatic, you couldn't talk about it.
You and you,
they pointed at each one to go inside the house.
Can I help you?
Hey there, Mr. Chisani. My name's Parker. I'm a radio reporter working
at... Parker what?
What did I think?
Yeah.
I assumed it meant that he had shot someone.
It's not a big deal. Everyday No more day in Haditha.
We're now joined by Madeline Barron, head reporter and host of the New Yorkers in the Dark podcast. She traveled to Haditha, Iraq, to meet with family members, the victims of the Haditha massacre. Her piece for the New Yorker is titled "The Haditha Massacre Photos That the Military Didn't Want the World to See." Welcome to Democracy Now!, Madeline. This is an astounding, what, 9-part podcast series and piece in The New Yorker with these photographs. You've interviewed hundreds of people, you and your team. First, talk about what these photographs mean now, so many years later, the significance of what they show and what happened with this massacre. Who was charged? Who was not held accountable?
Well, what these photos show, Amy, are direct evidence of what the Marines did that day in Haditha. I should say, I didn't personally travel to Haditha. We traveled to another part of Iraq, and we did send a reporter with more experience in the region to Haditha. But these photos show, as you can see, men, women, children in defenseless positions. In one case, a mother on a bed surrounded by her dead children. In another case, a mother in the corner of their living room with her arm around her 4-year-old boy, both of them killed, and they're, you know, face down on the ground, huddled, cowering in a corner. And so, you know, what the photos clearly show is that these were innocent people who do not appear to be doing anything threatening at the time of their deaths. And what happened with the Haditha cases is that 4 Marines initially were charged with murder, but all of those murder charges eventually went away. In 3 cases, the charges were dismissed. And in the final case, the one against the squad leader, Sergeant Frank Wooderich, that case did go to trial, but it ended in the middle of the trial with a plea deal for negligent dereliction of duty. It's a very low-level charge. Wooderich's own lawyer described it to me as basically akin to a parking ticket. They didn't carry a single day in prison or jail.
And Madeline, could you talk about your long battle to get these photos and the resistance that you met and why you persevered for so long?
Well, so this all started in 2020 when a reporter on our team, Parker Yesko, filed the first FOIA request by our team, trying to get not just the photos, but all of the investigative records into what happened in Haditha. You know, at the time when this killing happened, this was described as another My Lai. And yet, you know, we still know very little, at least when we started our reporting, knew very little about what even happened that day. So we filed this FOIA. The military really barely responded. And so we worked with a law firm who specializes in FOIA work, Lovie and Lovie, an amazing team led by a lawyer, Matt Topic. And they helped us sue the military. So we filed suit against the military. And then at that point, you know, we were still not necessarily getting anywhere. I mean, I don't think we ever thought it was at all a foregone conclusion that we would receive these photos. So we knew from, you know, reading the records, I had seen in the past that the U.S. military had made a claim that they wanted to keep the photos private because of concern, in part because of concern for the surviving family members of the dead. And so anticipating this concern, when I was in Iraq, I talked with one of the survivors and ultimately talked to two of the survivors and said, you know, what do you think about us trying to get these photos? And they both said, one is a man, Khalid Jamal, who was 14 when his father and uncles were killed. Another is Khalid Salman Rasif, who's a lawyer who lost 15 members of his family that day. And they both said, yes, we want you to have these photos. These photos are important. And so then they did something remarkable. Working with a reporter we sent there, they went house to house and talked to other surviving family members, explained our reporting to them, explained what we were trying to do, and had like a form with them that we had provided in Arabic and English that explained that this form would authorize us to try to obtain the photos with their permission from the U.S. military. And ultimately, those two men collected 17 signatures, and then we filed those in court. And then in March of this year, the military relented and sent us the photos.
We're going to play two clips for you from the podcast series, but start off by walking us through that day, November 19th, 2005.
So early that morning, the Marines set off a squad of Marines in a four-vehicle convoy, just a routine supply run. And one of those vehicles was hit by an IED, and it killed Lance Corporal Miguel Terrazas and injured two other Marines. In the hours that followed, the Marines shot five people by a white car near the site of the explosion. And then they went into three houses, and they killed men, women, and children inside. The oldest person they killed was a grandfather in his 70s, and the youngest was a three-year-old girl.
So this is retired Colonel Gregory Watt of the Army. He was first led a non-criminal investigation into what happened in Haditha, and this is him speaking in this podcast, In the Dark.
You know, my experience leads me to believe that this occurred 2006, 2007. No, it's now 2023. Mm. I think they've moved on.
Why do you think that?
I think it's human nature.
Even if your whole family was killed?
I believe so, especially in that region of the world.
What do you mean?
They have different values than we do. Okay, they're more concerned about the living than those that have passed.
I think I've talked to some of the survivors, and for them, it's really important to know as much as possible about how their family members were killed, and then also why no one was ever punished.
I don't have the answers to that.
So that's Colonel Gregory Watt from the In the Dark podcast. This is Khalid Jamal, who you just described, one of the survivors of the Haditha massacre, 14 at the time, his dad and three uncles killed by the Marines in 2005, responding.
One day, while we were talking with Khalid Jamal, we turned off the air conditioner in the hotel room because it was so noisy. But at one point, it got so hot, we had to take a break.
Yeah. Okay, let's turn on the air conditioning, take a little break.
Samara called down to the lobby and ordered coffee and pastries.
Hi, is this room service? Hi, I wanted to order...
While we were waiting, Khalid Jamal asked me a question. He asked me whether I had ever talked to Frank Wooderich.
Frank Wooderich?
Not yet, no.
And then Khalid Jamal said something surprising.
No sugar. I hope to meet him. Okay.
He wanted to talk to Wooderich.
I want to ask him...
Hold on.
I need to ask him one question, only just one question. How did he kill them? I want to explain how did he that in our house. How?
Khalid Jamal told us that he's always wanted to know what happened in his father and uncle's final moments.
I want that.
Why?
I want to know what's happened in Rome.
Because you don't know.
Yes. I saw the bodies only. I want to know how he did this killings of my father.
And this is Khalid Salman Rasif, 15 members of his family killed by the Marines in the Haditha massacre.
يعني تقريبا يعني يعني تناسينا الموضوع يعني الأحزان والأمور اللي كان في داخل القلب.
They kind of gave up on anyone talking about this case again. They didn't forget. They've been heartbroken every day since that day. But they gave up on someone talk about the case or someone reinvestigate the case.
So Madeleine Barron, it is now almost 20 years later. And you have the military, the representatives saying, why would they care? They can move on. Explain what you were most shocked by in what you discovered in these investigations, not to mention another man that they killed that day.
Well, of course, you know, the crime itself is shocking. You know, what happened that day is shocking. I think that, you know, as we got deeper and deeper into the reporting, it was also very interesting to see what happened in the years that followed. How, you know, I think really one of the big undertold parts of this whole story is the role of the surviving family members who have been quietly and persistently questing for justice for years now, and have done almost everything they can think of to try to reveal this story, to try to get justice for their dead family members. And I, you know, and have been repeatedly sort of left out of the process. You know, as we show in the podcast, at trial of the squad leader, none of the depositions, you know, the jury never heard any of the depositions of the survivors, the eyewitnesses to the killings who were Iraqi. You know, at trial, the prosecutors had asked to replace the names of the victims with numbers. And so at trial, the dead were referred to by the numbers that the Marines had scrawled on their bodies hours after the killings. And so I think there's also, you know, a story here about how we treat the Iraqi civilians and how we treated these particular Iraqi civilians in this case.
And Madeleine, could you talk about the role of General James Mad Dog Mattis, who went on to become Secretary of Defense in the Trump administration?
So Mattis played a very key role in this case. You know, Mattis was the person who most memorably in this case dismissed the charges against one of the Marines, a man named Lance Corporal Justin Sherritt. Sherritt is the one who killed three members of 14-year-old Khalid Jamal's family. And Mattis didn't just dismiss the charges. He also wrote Sherritt a very glowing, full of praise letter, saying that in his eyes, Sherritt was innocent, and praising Sherritt for how he had performed as a Marine. And, you know, this is something that Mattis, I think, to this day, it appears is very proud of. In his memoir, he even published the letter in his book.
And at this point, no one went to jail, Madeleine. We have 15 seconds.
Correct. No punishment, no jail time for the killings to this day. That's correct.
And the response of the Iraqis, the family members who survived?
What they want is the world to know what happened to their family, to know what their family were good people, not insurgents, and they want justice.
Madeleine Barron, I want to thank you for an astounding podcast series, In the Dark, head reporter and host of the New Yorker podcast. The new article in the New Yorker is The Haditha Massacre Photos That the Military Didn't Want the World to See. We will link to it all. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Thanks for joining us.
Join me, Robin, every Friday at noon for Roots and Berries. Tune in to hear bluegrass, old-time music, and other rootsy little nuggets with a focus on Canadian players, singers, and pickers. That's Roots and Berries, Fridays over the noon hour, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.
Listen to Home of Burnaby Rock, CJSF's Lux Rock Electronic Show. 2 hours of relative power each and every Friday, 6 to 8 p.m., and repeats every Thursday, 10 to midnight, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM. Do it.